Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock, Black Rock, Little Rock, Oskaloosa, Tennessee, Tennessee, Chicopee, Spirit Lake, Grand Lake, Devil's Lake, Crater Lake, Beach Lake. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. Stay close tonight. We may need you for some emergencies. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley. Again, we want to thank Johnny Cash, who keeps on trucking up there. He's visiting more than 90 cities and states, and who in the world could remember the words to that song? Emily and Mike, I see you over there tonight. Emily, we may have time for your story that fits in with our topic tonight. I'll keep folks in suspense about what that is. Let me make some opening comments here about what we're going to talk about tonight. I am reasonably safe in saying that we are going to be the only radio show on anywhere tonight where we're going to be talking about scent dog evidence and their acceptability in court. Now, how's that for an inside specialized subject? Yes, I said it, scent dog evidence and its acceptability in court. It should be a very interesting show and something that most folks know almost nothing about, but a very valuable service to the field of criminal justice, and particularly law enforcement and prosecution of criminals. The purpose of our show is what it is every week. We discuss the news and issues and events and developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. And we dedicate this show to the tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and indeed throughout the world. What we do in the show is sort of look inside criminal justice at its professionals and their particular practice. And this is a good example tonight of the topic that we're going to have, that is a very specialized but a very interesting field and a valuable field for the field of criminal justice. You're listening on Blog Talk Radio. It's blogtalkradio.com, and it's a leading technology started by Alan Levy back in the summer of last year. And in a matter of months, Blog Talk Radio hosts literally thousands of radio shows, and if you go to the Blog Talk Radio site and sort through the various genres there, you'll certainly find names of people, celebrities, authors that you know that host their own shows on Blog Talk Radio. But you don't have to be one of those famous people to do that. Obviously, right? I'm hosting one. Here's the possibilities. Any person, any interest group, any people that want to talk about anything, from darts to cigars to astronomy to homicide investigation to auto repair, can have their own show broadcasting live and streaming audio over the internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. And it's absolutely free, and you can do at least 14 hours a week of broadcasting. And, of course, folks can hear you around the world. So think of that. You can do it yourself, or any interest group or your own organization can have their own show broadcasting on the internet, and it's absolutely free. What a technology. What a way to share information among professionals and people of various interests. And the shows are archived within about sometimes 10 to 15 to 20 minutes. After the show's over, our show goes from 9 to 10 p.m., and then what you can do is you can either download it or you can replay it. And five shows stay active on the site where you can replay the last five shows. So if you don't like this show, as I'm fond of saying, get your own show. You'll have a chance. Shows that are coming up, let me tell you about some things I've made a few connections with, and I'll keep the details confidential at this moment, but we want to do something on tasers. And I found some folks that have a special interest in that. That's the little electric stun gun device that police and corrections officials and some others use in quelling disturbances and bring people under control that they need to take into custody. There's a lot of controversy about tasers. I think a lot of it's overblown, but we'll take a look at that. And then we'll want to do a whole show. We've touched on this in some other shows. We want to look at the surveillance camera business in depth. And then I have made some contacts about having two chaplains on, a police chaplain and a prison chaplain. I thought that would be interesting. And then the day before yesterday, I talked to somebody out in Wichita, Kansas, and he has spoken with an investigator that worked on the BTK killer case, something way out of my league. I have a blind spot when it comes to homicide cases, but of course that's a very famous one. And he was a detective that actually worked on the case and did a lot of the computer analysis relative to that. And we think that's going to be a show somewhere sometime in May. We're still getting clearance on that. So that should be very interesting. But tonight our guests are Sherry Warner and Stacy Sumoto. And they have done a very interesting study on the field of scent dogs. And the title of their study is called The Nose Knows, a case analysis of appeals court decisions concerning scent dog evidence acceptance. And they looked at, scores of these cases. And there are not many, but there are lots of different kinds of these dogs, and I'm going to let Sherry and Stacy tell you about that tonight. It should be very interesting. And what you can do as a listener is this. I'm going to bring our guests on in just a moment here. You can listen on your computer with a Windows Media Player, which you're probably doing. You can call in by phone. That can be cell phone, landline, Skype, whatever other type of phone service you have. You can hear the whole show on your phone. And our call-in number is 347-996-5983. That's 347-996-5983. And we can hold five calls at a time, and all five people can talk to each other at once, which is absolutely amazing if you stop and think about it. And that broadcasts, again, worldwide. Okay, Audrey, we have time, I think, I hope, for one more blonde joke. I'm going to bring one of our guests on right now. Let's see who this is. We say that a lot in Blog Talk Radio. Who is this?
This is Sherry Warnock.
Oh, Sherry Warnock. Well, thank you very much for coming on. We're really looking forward to hearing about your research and your study tonight. Certainly you don't run into a lot of people who have done studies in this area, do you?
No, that's part of what we found with our research is that that it's not a field that's researched a lot. We did find some research, but it's not something that's like overdone, like maybe drugs or juvenile or something like that.
I think there would be considerably less studies on your field versus juvenile delinquency, right?
Right.
Could you stand a blonde joke?
Sure.
A blonde, could you stand one? Well, you know, Audrey likes these blonde jokes. So she's got one tonight that you might enjoy. So I'm going to crank this one up and see what it sounds like. She promises this is a brief one, so we'll give it a try.
Professor Haley, thanks for the opportunity to tell another blonde joke. The one for tonight is brief. Two blondes lock their keys in the car. One of the blondes tries to break into the car, while the other one watches. Finally, the first blonde says, "This is terrible, I can't get into the car." The other blonde replies, "Keep trying, it looks like it is going to rain, and the convertible top is down."
Okay, Audrey, that was a winner, I think. I think she's found a cache of these somewhere, where she's got about 2 million stored up, so I think we have enough for the next several years of the radio show. Sherry, I got some criminal justice news here, if you're willing to comment on some of this with me. How about that?
Okay.
Yeah, this is, Ananova.com always lists some strange ones. And this is one I thought was a little bit odd, but gives me a flashback to a film here that was popular back in, I believe, the 1960s, about a robbery. But here's a man in Austria. He robbed a bank in order to get the money to buy fake breasts. It says here an Austrian man has been jailed after robbing a bank to pay for a breast operation for his transvestite lover. The car mechanic, Robert Steinler, 29, was caught just hours after he handed over £7,000 he had robbed from the bank in Grinsen, Austria, and he was paying this money to a plastic surgeon. The surgeon called the police because he was suspicious that the mechanic wanted to pay him so much money in cash up front for the operation. So that little task is costing him 6 years in prison. But, you know, There's no limits to true love, I guess, correct?
No, I guess not.
That's certainly an odd one. By now we've had a lot of things come in about the massacre at Virginia Tech, and wanted to just mention to the audience that a couple things that came out. You know, we always say that we had all these records and these databases in this business, we could stop some of this violence, and indeed we should be able to, but by now they found out, it took about a week, that under either the federal law or the Virginia law, Mr. Cho could not have gotten a gun. And had they followed up with the paperwork from mental health personnel and sent this in, then this, there's a chance that this wouldn't have happened. But of course, you know, he's around Washington, D.C. I imagine on the streets of Washington, he could probably find a gun pretty quick, but currently, there are 22 states that submit their mental health records to the Federal National Instant Criminal Background Check System, and so that means that there are 28 states that don't. But Virginia should have done that, and actually, had they done it with their own state system, he would have been disqualified from purchasing that gun too. So that's kind of interesting. We depend on records, and you know, sometimes they work in the workforce and sometimes they don't. Well, Sherry, what do you think? I think I've got a couple other stories here, but I know you've got a long, detailed study and very interesting folks to get the gist of what you've been doing and what you've been finding out about this very interesting field of set dogs. So why don't you just go ahead and start off, and I'll chime in here and there and see what we come up with.
Okay. Well, myself and Stacy, we studied 40 cases from Supreme Court and appellate court cases where scent dog evidence was used. And what we were wanting to know was, in how many of those cases was the evidence suppressed or questioned, or what the court decisions were concerning the evidence. And we found that overwhelmingly the evidence is considered admissible and acceptable. The Supreme Court established a sort of precedent where if a dog is walked around an inanimate object and the dog alerts to a scent from the inanimate object, that that is in itself probable cause for a search. And what we found in most of these cases, people did try to suppress the evidence under the Fourth Amendment or due process, but we only found one case in particular that was overturned. And reading the summary, I believe it was overturned more because of the man's, the dog's credentials. They had an expert come in, the defense had an expert come in and give six reasons why this dog should not be, why his training wasn't sufficient. And I think that was probably more damaging to the case than anything.
Generally, what do these dogs do, actually? What categories of work do they operate in? I mean, people probably realize narcotics dogs, but what else are they doing, Sharon?
Well, yes, there's the narcotics dogs. There's dogs who, what I found most interesting were what they call cadaver dogs. And what they do is they actually sniff the air, not the ground, with the idea of finding a crime scene or human remains. I thought that was rather interesting because you have, you know, you have a field where you think somebody might have been murdered, and you put this dog out in this 1 mile radius, and the dog uses the scent in the air to try and locate the remains or the where the crime may have happened. Another thing they're using dogs for is evidence collection itself, where maybe something's been cleaned up, evidence of a crime has been tried to clean up, and the dog's been able to go in and find evidence. Now, we didn't find any cases like that in our search. Seems to be something that happens primarily in Europe. They use the dogs mostly in a lot of ways that we don't in Europe.
What kind of dogs, or is there any way of knowing the dog's scent? How does their nose capabilities compare to human beings, for example?
We found one study that indicated the dog has a scent 44,000 times stronger than a human scent.
Oh, my.
And can't even imagine that, can you?
A dog must spend some uncomfortable days, right?
You would think, yeah. Well, and they're more capable of distinguishing scents. For instance, a dog handler I once knew, she was on the highway patrol, and what she the way she described it to me is if I was to go to her house for dinner, when I walked in, I might be able to distinguish, oh, we're having fish for dinner, based on the smell. Whereas a dog going in to the same location would be able to say, oh, we're having fish and green beans and potatoes and so on, you know, would be able to distinguish more smells.
Where humans would probably be caught up with the overriding smell, I suppose, right?
Right, right. And it's fascinating, some of the new ways that they're learning to use these dogs, such as we found an incident where, you know, the pirating of DVDs is concerned. And the dog, of course, can't distinguish a pirated DVD from a regular DVD, but it can hit on the scent of the DVDs, which would give grounds for a search to determine if they were pirated or not.
So that would be
something that,
like in smuggled cases of DVDs, or
yes, in pirated and smuggled cases for DVDs.
Right. That is interesting. When these things get trained, I know from the regular general purpose dogs that we used to train at the police academy here, Peace Officer Academy here in London, Ohio. They went through a lot of training. It was like a 3-week course, and the handler and the dog went through the training together. And the dog came and slept at the academy just like the the officers did. And then all their testing was primarily field-based. In other words, they had to go through different types of sequences of tests. And I know your study hit on some of that in terms of what these dogs have to go through. And I think you mentioned one or a place in Florida that's rather well-known worldwide for doing this, right?
That's correct. That's at the Florida University. Let me go scroll back here so I can get the name correct on that. Here we go. It's that they train dogs. They get grants, government grants, and they're able, a lot of this training they're able to offer free. And the dogs are, they come to them from, geez, all over the world, to include Haiti and the Dominican Republic. And
mm-hmm.
It's the, let me see here, National Forensic Science Technology at Florida International University.
Mm-hmm.
And it's run by PhDs.
Mm-hmm.
These people have particular educations and PhDs. And then they also have been hosts to the National Detector Dog Conference, which meets annually to discuss, they discuss, you know, to define dog detection practices whatever latest research is or something.
Well, the people that trained these that I was familiar with, they were very adamant about the procedures that you use. And there was this competition between these two groups. I can't even remember the names, but they had these are like two different approaches on how you do this.
Okay.
And each was, I think it was one was the North American Police Dog Association or something like that, and then the other one had something to do with the German method of training. I can't remember the name of that, but boy, they were really on the opposite sides of the fence. So we were writing the law to get this, you know, put into the administrative code so that training would be accepted and it could be court tested and all that. We had to come to some terms eventually.
I remember when a lot of that was going on. I was a new police officer at that time, a sort of rookie, and I was working with the Licking County Drug Enforcement Task Force at that time, and so I was, I got acquainted with dogs out of that. And I remember that debate.
What particular breeds of dogs work in this category?
Well, a number of breeds. There was actually a study done by the British Leicestershire. You would say Leicestershire. Anyway, they did some research on. First they wanted to determine whether or not it was possible to evaluate the dogs and to give the dogs more credibility, especially as this global terrorism going on. And that was their main goal. But they also figured out that they were able to evaluate dogs based on their breed and sex as well. And what they found was that the male German Shepherds seemed to do best out of the different dogs that they tested.
Yeah. And you see, it seems like if you travel to Europe, they seem much more prevalent than they do here. Of course, we don't really have that type of overt security in airports and things. At least it doesn't appear to be that way. But you see it all over Europe, dogs, a lot of different places.
Yeah, in the airports and the bus stations.
If I were pressed about it, I don't think, you can't recall the last time I even saw a dog at an airport in the United States, but I'm sure they're there.
I probably somewhere in the back. Well, they don't want to scare people.
go ahead.
But we found in our study that, we had 25 different states represented in our study, so it's about half the states. And we found overall, though, that the dog's credibility, the dog himself, the credibility of the dog scent itself was not contested. No one ever said dogs can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
But what we did find contested was the handlers, questions about the handlers or the dog's training came up a lot. The dogs were used mostly in our study, I think it was 18 cases where the dogs were used for drug interdiction. But we did also have some cases where they were used for money laundering, murder, larceny, robbery, vehicle theft, various things like that. 17 cases were reversed, remanded, or discharged, or the sentence was vacated due to issues. But they were due to issues other than the scent dog reliability.
It's something different than the dog itself then, as you said.
Yeah. It seems to be very acceptable. And the two cases that went to the Supreme Court are sort of landmark cases. One of them was named, I think one of them, the defendant's name was Corellis. I think it was Illinois, Indiana. But it seemed to involve a bus station where there was luggage, and the dog was walked around this pile of luggage, and the dog hit on one of the bags. And then the case proceeded from there. And the Supreme Court totally supported that there was no violation of the Fourth Amendment, that this dog would just arbitrarily hit on this bag out of a selection of a number of bags. I guess what my concern is when we embarked on the study, and I didn't develop the concern until we actually did the study, is that because the Supreme Court has said a dog alert on an object does give a person probable cause for a search, I have a concern that this might be seen as a sort of carte blanche, to get into. We have to be, anytime that as law enforcement we're given something like this, we have to be very prudent and responsible about its use.
So if not so ethical cops wanted to trick this up a little bit, how could they do it? In other words, if they wanted to, legitimize, quote-unquote, any search they wanted, what, they could just have Fido jump on anything, huh?
Yeah. We found two cases that I thought were kind of questionable. One was in New Mexico. An officer stopped a van for, I think it was erratic driving,
mm-hmm.
and it was a Hispanic driver. And he detained the vehicle probably longer than he should have, waiting on a dog to arrive from another county. He gave the driver a warning. And you see, I take issue with that, too. If you're going to pull someone over, it's probably worth writing the ticket, especially if you're thinking something's going on and that you may need a dog and to do a search. But they give warnings, and so that doesn't make sense to me. But so he's giving the driver a warning about this erratic driving, and at the same time he's saying, I've got a dog coming, and I'm going to walk the dog around your vehicle because I think you have some illegal immigrants in your vehicle, in your van. And when the dog arrives, the dog is walked around and there's no hit. So then he says, well, I'm going to let the dog in your vehicle because now I think, I think they're inside the vehicle. So without this guy's consent, he lets the dog in the vehicle. And there was no hit for illegal aliens, but there was a hit for, I think it was a small bag of marijuana. And it just seemed, and then all of a sudden, well, now the case has turned to, okay, now I have you for this small bag of marijuana or whatever it was. And you see, it's just an example, I guess, I'm trying to demonstrate where this was an abuse. Because a person has a right to not give consent. You an officer can't say, well, I'm going to just walk my dog around your vehicle. I'm, going to let my dog in your vehicle.
So was that a ruse done on the part of that officer about the illegal aliens? Was he really looking for something else? Or?
I don't really know. I can't say based on the summary that was given. It's possible that he was, what's the term, profiling? Dare I say the term profiling? But that was one incident that was overturned.
The other people, right?
Pardon me?
Would have smelled the other people in the van then, right? Or whatever type of vehicle it was.
Yes, if there had been other people in the van, the dog certainly would have discovered them. But the dog should have been able to smell them from outside the van, but the dog didn't hit on a walk around the outside of the van.
And with dogs like that, are they trained, are they certified for something particular, like this dog has been certified to find narcotics? Right. Certified to find people?
Sometimes dogs are cross-trained a little bit. So you could cross-train a dog for tracking and also cross-train the dog for a narcotic sniff. But you cannot train a cadaver dog for anything but cadaver evidence.
Okay.
And vice versa. You don't want to train a narcotics dog for cadaver.
One of the issues in the case appeals might be cross-contamination or something of the scent and.
Right. I walk my dog around your car and it hits on your trunk, and I ask you, can I look in your trunk? And you tell me, well, a cat died in there last week, and that's probably what he's hitting on. And I've cross-trained the dog for death scent, then. Yeah, that becomes questionable.
Mm-hmm. Boy, it's complicated in some of these appeals cases, couldn't it?
Yes, and that's why, that's why police officers really need to educate themselves as much as they can about, the laws that are going through the Supreme Court. I mean, the police department's responsible for a lot of training and giving out the training, but, why lose a case? If it's as simple as getting on the internet and just reading some cases, something that interests you.
I think there are our listeners that are, outside of the criminal justice or law enforcement field specifically don't realize how often officers' training records are brought into court. But I was surprised at that myself until I headed up one of those agencies, and they are subpoenaed fairly regular basis. For all sorts.
Yeah. Oh yes, to include disciplinary records.
Yes. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I never encountered that in court, but I was aware of some other cases.
Yeah,
of course, there's the notorious O.J. Simpson case where they subpoenaed everything of Furman's.
You want to hear a funny one? This occurred somewhere down in southeast Ohio. I can't remember the exact details and locations, and probably shouldn't say it anyway, but firearms instructors, in fact, he was the head of firearms unit. He was subpoenaed to get out and testify in a case where a gentleman had found a possum in the front yard right outside of one of these older 50s-type, ranch-type homes. It was right underneath the picture window. So they called the police, which is a call that you have probably been on or calls like that in times past.
Yeah.
Get this thing out of my yard. So the officer comes, and yeah, sure enough, there's that possum in the front yard. So walks back to the front, like the sidewalk, and there's a little embankment there. And he lays down on the ground, little embankment. Takes his pistol down and cranks off several rounds into the possum and into the side of the house.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So the police department thought this is something that they should fire him for. That may not have been the best judgment of what to do. So they subpoenaed the records, and of course the issue there was, and his defense was, he said he wasn't caught
the firm saying how to handle a case like that.
Oh, dear.
Would that be a case for having IQ tests again in policing?
It could be. I don't think it was the smartest thing for him to do.
Sure. I can remember my own childhood where the police shot a dog in our front yard that was hit by a car.
Uh-huh.
And my gosh, I must have been 10, and I never forgot that. I mean, it just, oh, my Lord, the police shoot the dog. And, but it's something that happens, you know, depending where you are. And, of course, the officers that work out in places like New Mexico and Montana and stuff like that, the things that they hit and see hit, just incredible. What is kind of new in this area? What's come along that?
Well, other than the DVDs, we have some future ideas. You and I had previously discussed the possibility of dogs being used for, like, example, Virginia Tech. And I was saying about how it may not exactly be feasible because the dog would have to be trained to attack the gun,
mm-hmm.
assuming that this man is the only person with a gun. And the dog would have to be trained to attack the gun. You'd have to have a number of dogs to do this, not just one, because the first dog in is going to get shot. And then there's the possibility if someone got up to run or something, the dog may change direction and tackle, you know, the person running. And then you have to have all the specialized training for the dog and keep the dog well trained. And, you know, how often do we really have, I mean, as horrifying as it is, how often do we have such an incident? So, you know, and then you can't tell where it's going to happen at.
Where you worked as a police officer, did they have canine units?
Yes, we did.
And we didn't. And the idea behind that was that it was too reminiscent of, you know, Bull Connor and the Old South and segregation.
Right. Well, that was an unfortunate incident that he unleashed those dogs on people. And it was a case that did prevent a lot of police departments from acquiring dogs in the 60s and 70s. Dog use became more prevalent in the 80s, particularly the later 80s and 90s. We got our first dog unit, I think, in 93, 94 at Newark, and this officer really had to sell the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And we were quite glad to have the dog. The dog came in handy a number of times for things. I had a car. I pulled over, and the driver ran into a field. And it was dark, and we were able to use the dog to track the man down and bring him back out of the field, and he surrendered easily once he heard the dog barking. And he was driving under suspension, and he was DUI, and these were the reasons why he ran. So yeah, they come in handy for I think a number of things.
Well, certainly buildings outstanding for that, I think.
Right now, the Pentagon is looking into these dogs to identify terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the chemicals they use to make bombs, and the dog would be able to alert to the smell of the chemicals on the person. Another use may be, again, this is the United Kingdom. They're finding that, well, and dogs have been used for this before, finding pests like termites and weeds and even some types of cancer, believe it or not.
Does it happen a lot that, like, lost children and things that are eventually found and, you know, they end up in some mountain park location and they wander off? Are dogs responsible for finding a lot of those, or at least sometimes?
I think they are probably used for that. When we did some of our research on the internet initially, I found where dogs were used for finding missing persons or children that have wandered off. And, of course, those aren't the cases that end up in research studies, you know. But, yeah, there have been cases for that. And there have been cases where the dog's been used to find, in one case, it was a police officer had been killed. And the dog, I think, traced the body of the officer was not at the crime scene. And I can't remember which way it went, whether the dog traced from the crime scene to the body or the body back to the crime scene. But the dog was used that way as well. There seems to be, it just seems to really be a growing field, and it seems like it's rather unlimited what these dogs may be capable of doing. As we use them more, we'll probably discover more that they're capable. What I thought was interesting was the scent dog lineup, where...
tell us about that.
Well, it's where, now, it's used in Holland and in those countries a lot there in that part of Europe. But what they do, apparently, if they have a suspect, and, of course, the handler can't know who the suspect is, but they take an item from the crime scene that has the suspect's scent on it, give that to the dog, and then the dog goes through the lineup and picks the suspect.
How about that? Huh. And that's, I guess then, either they get a confession or a follow-up with other evidence or whatever, right?
Well, yes, you cannot convict solely on that. But, yeah, they establish, you know, they'll have corroborating evidence or yeah, the guy quite readily confesses when he's confronted with this positive ID from a dog.
You know, one of the, you're talking about the cases, I just thought of one. I used to, several times, I didn't normally work that area, but a couple times I did. There was a tire factory. I mean, an enormous tire factory. It was like, you know, like blocks. And in there, all these stacked tires, all the way up like to the ceiling.
Uh-huh.
These tires are constantly falling. I mean, they're always falling. And so eventually, when a bunch of them, too many of them fall, they set off the burglar alarm.
Right.
This was ADT systems, and they would respond. And of course, you're supposed to respond, and you have to search the building for the burglar. But this place was so large that they had strategically placed bicycles, you know, throughout the place. So the cops or whoever, even their own employees, if they had to go very far. You could get on the bike.
Okay.
Police officers would actually get on the bike and drive around. You know, I always had this, and then tires are actually falling while you're looking for the burglars. And you think, tire, you know, you draw your gun, it's, you know, it's two tires bouncing down the aisle. But how great that would have been to send a dog in there.
Yeah.
Take care of that search in a fraction of the time that we'd normally do. And I can say that some people were sort of careless about doing that search.
dogs are great for searching large areas because they can move so quickly, and of course they're observing the scents on the ground, and they just seem to instinctively know what they're looking for, who they're looking for.
What did you find out about the people that actually have this assignment, or the ones you've known? You have to sort of want to really do this, don't you, to be a handler?
Yes, the dog and handler team, they have to have a special bond, and that's been established through research as well. If the dog's treated as a mere object and he's forced to do these things out of fear, the dog isn't going to perform well. Whereas if the dog's performing out of an affection and a desire to please his owner, and then the dog will perform very well. I forget what research article that was, but that was established through a recent article.
So these dogs are trained the positive reinforcement type of procedures, is that how it works?
That's correct. Usually, you know, in the beginning they might use food or something to get the dog's interest, but then but then it becomes praise. The food reward is replaced with praise.
It's funny because one of the best trained dogs I've ever seen, and was one owned by a police chief that I know, and he was chief in Tennessee and chief in Ohio, and I won't call out his name, but this dog was it was almost human. It was so well trained.
Mm-hmm.
He did it by smacking the thing.
Smacking him.
Yeah. When he didn't do the right thing. He claimed that that was the best way to train this dog, and I'm telling you, this dog was almost elegant. Mm-hmm. Carried itself.
Well, I guess if that's what worked with that dog, I don't know how well that would have worked with my dog, but of course I haven't trained him for much.
That was a Doberman Pinscher, so you know, yeah. I had a dog for 13 years, and you know what they're like. You go wake them up when you want them.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the training, though, seems to be centered on behaviorist theory. So I don't know. I don't think smacking the dog would fit into behaviorist theory.
Did you find much in there in your studies, just sort of as a cross find about arson dogs?
Yeah, well, there was a little discussion about arson dogs. And there's a recent article the FBI just put out that I just saw that isn't in my study, about dogs alerting to accelerants. The nice thing about that you can you suspect maybe arson, and so you let the dog in to smell, sniff around, it saves a lot of time for the investigation, because otherwise you would have to clean everything up and, like, thoroughly search through all these charred remains to try and find the accelerant evidence.
Yeah, I think I mentioned to you that when we were talking about this before, that there was the dog that came to one of my classes. The arson dog is a guest speaker.
Uh-huh.
They would take these things and put them inside of a tube and seal them. These rags or something, and he was, this one was trained on, I think, 14 or 15 different accelerants where it had been certified to find each one.
Mm-hmm.
And they went out, we went outside, and they threw this dog on the tube away, I mean, you know, 50, 70 yards away, and then brought the dog out, and by golly, that dog started looking for it and started digging up the flowers around the university. Went and found that thing.
Yeah.
And the handler of the dog said that actually they were going to, you know, they were going to continue the train, that some of those dogs had actually been certified to find like 18, 20 different accelerants.
Right. But they're all accelerants. There's not the cross-training to narcotics or something. There was a time when... as I recall, when I was an officer, there was talk about some of these people were actually wrapping up these bricks of marijuana or cocaine or whatever around with coffee to try and confuse the dogs.
Yes.
And also there was talk about they were using cyanide, so if the dog did sniff, the dog would die, in the hopes that... you know, the police would be more reluctant to do searches. But I didn't find really any of that in my research. That's just from personal experience.
Have you spent much time in England?
Yes. My mother's from England, so I've been there on and off over the years.
Do they use the dogs more than we do, would you think, or not?
Well, from what I've read... I think so, but when I was in England, I really didn't see dogs that much, except, like you said, at the airports or the bus stations.
The last decade or so, they've probably picked up a lot, I would think, and particularly after, a couple of summers ago. So.
Yeah. Well, after 9/11, it probably picked up quite a bit. I haven't been there since 94.
I see.
Was the last time I was there. I talked to I talk to my relatives quite frequently, but the subjects never come up.
Well, since you've been there last, there's probably 3.5 more million surveillance cameras.
There probably is. There's probably doubled the population again. When I was there in 94, it seemed so crowded. I mean, I had gone in 75, and then I didn't go back again until 94. And in those 20 years, it just seemed that everything was just so populated. There didn't seem to be quiet streets anymore, or, you know, to go to the little neighborhood pub just wasn't as quaint anymore, you know?
If I could go back to our study here, just for a moment, what were some of the agencies that were included in this? I know you listed all those out in your study, in your methodology, but what were some of the places? Like, were some state police, some local cops?
Well, most of it was law enforcement. We did have one case that was a private entity, and then we had one case where it was they borrowed a dog from a local prison.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the prison systems use them too, don't they? That's right.
Yes. They tend to use bloodhounds more. We did have one case where these people objected to the evidence because the evidence was discovered by a German Shepherd instead of a bloodhound. And then they said it was because the law was written for bloodhounds only and not for German Shepherds. And they did try and make a contest. Yeah, that was, of course, that didn't fly very well, but they did try to make a case of that.
Who's supposed to have the better nose on that, the bloodhound or the German Shepherd?
Well, it depends on what you're looking for. Bloodhounds are supposed to have the better nose for tracking.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if they used bloodhounds in their study or not. The United Kingdom, in their study, determined that it was a male German Shepherd had the best nose. So, golden retrievers are being used now because, you know, the retriever and the Labrador and that, they're hunting dogs. But if you have, say, a golden retriever, their mouths are very soft. And so you wouldn't want to train that dog for a bite dog.
Oh, I see. I never thought about that, right.
You would want to restrict that dog's use for maybe cadaver searching or something where the dog wouldn't encounter having to bite.
Yeah, do you remember hearing about the British police training dogs to butt people in the chest and knock them down instead of bite them?
No, I don't recall that study. I don't recall that.
I have a news article about that where, they had, a series of cases where the dogs, they grab you, they bite you to bring you down.
Mm-hmm. Right.
People were complaining about this, so they actually trained at some where they put a little steel muzzle on the front of them, and
mm-hmm.
the dog comes right for your chest, like a missile, or your back.
Ow. They knock you down.
When they miss you, but
yeah.
And fire again, but that's odd, isn't it?
Yeah, that's odd. Well, I've known that they've tried many different dogs. Great Danes for a while were considered for police work, but the problem with the Great Dane is that they mature later in life, and so they stay in the puppy stage way too long, and they're a little, too goofy. It takes a special dog to be this sort of dog, and although all dogs, are trainable, it's not to say that a dog isn't trainable, but it takes a special dog to do this kind of work.
Seems to me like to train dogs to do attacking, this would be a nice thing for a collection of pit bulls to do, wouldn't it?
Well, you'd think, but they're kind of small. Pit bulls tend to be a little small. And you kind of want a bigger dog. A lot of the bigger dogs, though, are gentle dogs. How I got my dog, he's a hybrid timber wolf. He's 3/4 wolf and 1/4 shepherd. And at the time, they were experimenting with the hybrid timber wolves to get a bigger size out of the German Shepherd. because a wolf can get up to 120 pounds and about 6 feet long, whereas a shepherd is more 4 feet, 60 pounds, 70 pounds. The only thing is that wolves actually are timid. So I think it's more, it's not so much the breed of the dog as I think it's just the individual personality of the dog, whether or not the dog's got the play drive and the desire to please his owner and has, you know, can be aggressive enough. My dog, I tried to train him for bite work, but he wouldn't, it was all play for him and he wouldn't bite hard enough.
You know, dog bites are something that we always worried about going to Bucharest, Romania with when we had the grant to work with those folks over there. Because on the streets of Bucharest, when we first went over there, there were 200,000 dogs.
Jeez.
These dogs had been interbreeding for 15 or 20 years on the streets because the people weren't allowed to keep them in their apartments.
Mm-hmm.
Their dictator, Ceausescu, knocked down all of the homes, thousands, tens of thousands of homes in Bucharest, and then put these people in apartments, and they all, many have had dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So people have a dog, but it lives actually on the street. Kind of like some people have cats, right?
Right.
Cats, plenty other people. But so people are actually worried about dog bites a lot over there, and a couple people had to go through the shots because they were bitten. But I never had any problems with them, but I often thought about it.
Yeah, you'd want to carry, I would think you'd want to carry some sort of repellent, like mailman.
Yeah. Well, Jerry, this is really, is there anything else you want to say about the study? It sounds like a fascinating study, and I know you and Stacy are going to publish the article, I'm sure.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it being published, and I'm hoping to receive some good remarks from the University of Florida when I send it there, too. We work really hard on this to try and make sense out of all the cases. You know, the summaries get a little long.
I can imagine, yeah. How long were some of those in the law journal?
Well, it depended on which site you went to. LexisNexis, those summaries were fairly brief and concise. But some of the other sites we were on, you'd have, you know, I mean, it took us 8 hours to sift through 40 cases. So some of the reading was could be rather long in trying to find, okay, where was the dog used, how was the dog used, and what was the conclusion about the case, and how did that, you know, reflect on the dog. Yeah, those the case summaries, you know, they you almost need a dictionary with you, too, when you read those.
I'm very pleased you came on the show tonight. And
oh, well, thank you for having me.
You're telling me it's getting close to quitting time, and she keeps a watch on that clock pretty close. And
have that.
we'll be signing off, and thank you very much, Sherry. And tell Stacy hello, too.
Okay, I will. Thank you.
And folks, you can look on the website, www.blogtalkradio.com/PeteHaley, and you can see what the shows are that will be coming up. And we're glad that you joined us. We'll be closing out tonight, and we'll be seeing you again. Goodbye.
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. He's smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue sky drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. Sunny day.